Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
First, let's get the latest reaction to President Obama's plans for military action against ISIS. The president is planning to send almost 500 more advisors to Iraq to train Iraqi security forces. He also plans to launch airstrikes in Syria in addition to the ongoing strikes against ISIS in Iraq. And he says he'll have a broad coalition of countries behind him. But a lot of questions remain, including whether the president needs additional authorization from Congress to do all of this. NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now from Washington. Mara, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And what is the reaction today from lawmakers on Capitol Hill to what the president said last night?
Well, the bottom line is they support him. Both House Speaker John Boehner, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi in the House say they support the president's strategy. There's plenty of complaints from Republicans, of course, that he didn't do this sooner, that he neglected the problem of ISIS. Some Republicans don't want him to explicitly rule out using ground troops. But for the most part, this strategy is getting support from both parties.
And there's nobody out there saying, don't do anything.
No, you can't be on the side of doing less against ISIS now that the American public has spoken through polls. They see it as a threat. Those gruesome beheadings really did change things.
And what about the question of authorization? We spoke today with Ben Rhodes, the deputy national security advisor to the White House, who says the president has the authorization he needs in the form of the 2001 authorization for use of military force. But that specifically says that it is for use of force against those responsible for the September 11th attacks 13 years ago, which would not be ISIS.
That's right. But there are people, certainly constitutional scholars and some members of Congress who think he needs authorization. But for the most part, Congress is happy not to vote on this right before the election. And the president is going to go forward. He'll notify Congress under the War Powers Act, under his powers inherent as commander in chief. And he's going to go forward without an explicit congressional authorization. He says he welcomes congressional support. He'd be happy if they took a vote in support of this. The one thing he is asking Congress to do specifically is Congress will have to vote on the $500 million he wants to spend arming and training the moderate Syrian rebels. Hmm. That is something he is asking Congress to do, and I expect Congress will do it.
And what about this broad coalition that the president talked about in his speech last night of other countries? We remember President Bush talking about the coalition of the willing, and there are not a lot of specifics from the president about who's in this broad coalition.
Well, there are a lot of countries who are willing to help us. And after the NATO summit last week, the president came back with commitments from the kind of allies that you'd expect: Germany, the UK, Poland, France, but also Jordan, the UAE, Saudi Arabia. He talked to the King of Saudi Arabia yesterday before the speech. Saudi Arabia has said it will train the rebels on its own territory, although a lot of the training will be conducted by the American military. So there is a broad coalition. And one of the key pieces of the president's strategy is if the U.S. is going to take the lead in airstrikes and other countries are going to provide financing, intelligence, training, it's really important that Sunni Muslim countries like Saudi Arabia step up. This ISIS is a Sunni Muslim extremist group. They have to get some kind of opposition from other Sunni Muslims in the region.
So saying that they've got this support from Saudi Arabia, although we're hearing today from Germany and from the United Kingdom that they're not going to be involved in airstrikes, you're saying as long as these countries are doing other things, that the White House would be happy with that?
Yes, of course. And everybody has an expertise that they can bring to this.
Okay, let's talk about the speech last night more, Mara. What stuck out to you?
Well, the biggest thing was what a departure this is. This is a president who ran on a platform of getting us out of wars in the Middle East. He wanted to get the country off a permanent war footing. He said he doesn't like the idea of having to play whack-a-mole. Every so often, a terrorist group rears its head and the U.S. has to strike against it. But he really has become a war president now. Not the same kind of war that we've been fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, but he's changed his mind. And so have the American people. As I mentioned, the polls have have changed since ISIS beheaded two American journalists?
He changed his mind before the American people changed their mind, or along with, or after?
I think along with.
What about this tricky line, Mara, between hurting ISIS and helping Assad in Syria? The president is not a fan of either of these groups, and the U.S. is it sounds like enemies of both. But you help one, you might help the you might hurt the other.
Well, that's one of the big questions about the strategy. I mean, the president also said not long ago that the Free Syrian Army, the moderate rebels that he now proposes to equip and train and use as our boots on the ground in Syria, were just a bunch of doctors and pharmacists and teachers, and they really weren't ready for prime time. So the big question is, can the U.S. make them ready? What kind of strikes can we do against ISIS in Syria that won't end up helping Assad? There are also questions about the strategy in Iraq. We insisted that there be a new government there that was more inclusive, that included Sunnis. They got a new government, but will that government be inclusive enough to convince Iraqi Sunnis that they have to get on board against ISIS? So lots of questions there.
And the big question is, how long is this going to last? And it does look like this is something that could very well be started under this president and continued under the next.
No doubt about it. He said this isn't going to be quick. It'll last for at least 3 years. I think this is a long war. He will be leaving this to his successor. It's a generations-long conflict. But the White House would stress, as the president does all the time, but not the kind of war like Afghanistan and Iraq, where tens of thousands of American combat troops are there.
Mara Liasson, NPR national political correspondent, joining us from Washington. Mara, thank you.
Thank you.
Today, there were ceremonies in a field in Pennsylvania, at the Pentagon, and in Manhattan to mark this, the 13th anniversary of the September 11 attacks. President Obama, fresh off that speech last night on confronting ISIS, observed a moment of silence at the White House and laid a wreath at the Pentagon. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel also spoke to the audience there.
We live at a time of many complicated challenges, but America has always faced challenges. And we have always responded as a nation united in purpose, woven together in a fabric of strong character and resounding commitment to each other and to our country.
Meanwhile, in New York, the names of the 2,983 people killed were read again.
Brian Eugene Bilcher.
Mark Bingham.
Carl Vincent Beeney.
And my uncle, Frank Paul Wisniewski. We all miss you terribly.
And my brother is
Stephen Nessen is with WNYC in New York. And Stephen, that just never fails, you know, to get you. But was it different this year at all? You've been there in past years. What was it like today?
Well, this is a yearly ritual for these families. They arrive very early as the sun is coming up and sort of walk around the memorial pools, which, you know, are there now. And they touch the parapets there made out of bronze with the names sort of engraved in them. They place flowers there, but they've been doing this for many years, and I've been covering it for several years, and every year I see the familiar handmade posters for those who died on 9/11, the sort of very thoughtful hand lettering, faded photos, and every year it's sort of an interesting mix. You know, some people are dressed very formally for the occasion, dark clothes, somber colors. Other people are dressed in shorts and T-shirts, and they bring those camping chairs to sort of sit on the plaza and listen. You see families walking around, hugging each other. These are strangers, you know, that were brought together by a terrible tragedy, but they've actually become quite good friends with these different families and rely on them for support. As one woman said that I spoke with, you know, many have experienced death in their family, but only those who've lost loved ones on 9/11 really understand that particular kind of loss.
Well, in fact, let's listen. You spoke to Eleni Kasulis. Her sister Danielle was killed in the Twin Towers.
Coming here every year, I just find some, you know, there's a comfort in being with the other families and in understanding, you know, having the shared experience. They understand without even saying anything, like, what you're feeling. And there is something to be said, you know, about that, about being able to, for them to relate about what you're going through because they've gone through the same thing. So I do find, you know, some comfort in that.
And so some comfort there. But this is also the first time the National September 11th Memorial and Museum has really been a part of the anniversary ceremony. So, Stephen, tell us more about that. What's the significance and what's happening?
Sure. Well, Mayor Bloomberg, who was in charge when the memorial opened, really push to get it open. And it was opened very recently in May. And this is the first anniversary where families have been able to go there on the anniversary. Before that, they would actually go underground, sort of 70 feet down to bedrock, where the very bottom of the towers were, because that's where their loved ones' remains were. And many are still to this day. Many people have not recovered any remains from their family. So this is kind of like their cemetery. Yeah. And it's a very interesting, complicated museum. People have very mixed emotions about it. It's so overwhelming on the one hand with all the artifacts from that day, the posters, the movies, the voices. It's a lot for a family member who's lost someone on 9/11 to take in. At the other, on the other hand, there is some private space there where they can go and commemorate their loved one. Also, there's the Memorial Plaza above ground, which is just very recently open to the public during the day. They can go, anyone can walk in the morning and walk around. So for some families, this is a little bit painful. You know, you have a million tourists coming to this museum. 15 million people in the last 4 months have come to this plaza. So to have to mourn so publicly is very difficult for some people. And some families have bristled at the visitors who go and sit there and have their lunch. And, you know, people take selfies there as you do anywhere. But for some, it's quite a sacred site. So it's... there are very mixed emotions here.
So if you go, keep that in mind. But of course, Stephen, we today are commemorating that terrible attack 13 years ago from what was then a new enemy, Al-Qaeda. Another has since formed out of the same well, if you will. And last night, the president talked about attacking ISIS. Were people noting that strange coincidence today?
I asked some folks about that. There were several recent, very young Marines who were there at the memorial just to take a look and check it out. And they said they were not, they didn't see the connection. They didn't believe in it. They thought it's very separate situations, separate incidents. So they didn't know.
Yeah. Stephen Nesson of WNYC in New York, commenting on today's commemoration of what happened there 13 years ago. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
Longtime Boston author Dennis Lehane has had books made into films, Mystic River, Gone Baby Gone. For the new movie The Drop, he wrote the screenplay first and then the book. The screenplay was actually based on a short story about a guy who finds a pitiful dog left for dead in a trash can. Bob, played in the movie by Tom Hardy, tends to take in strays. He lives frozen in amber in his late parents' house and tends to neighborhood drunks as they dream of a more glorious past. In his job as bartender at his cousin Marv's bar. There is change in the air. The Boston Irish gangs have been replaced by vicious Chechen bookmakers. In this scene from the film, Cousin Marv, played by the late James Gandolfini, rails from his barca lounger at Bob, whose eyes are opening.
When I walked into a place people sat up, they sat up straight. They noticed. What'd you ever have? A bar stool that you put that old biddy at and bought her free drinks, and don't think I don't know that you did it on purpose. That was my stool, and nobody sat on that stool because it was Cousin Marv's stool. And that meant something. That meant something.
But it didn't. Ever. It was just a stool.
Soon, a vicious ex-con is coming for that stray dog. The police and the Chechens are coming for Bob and Marv, each digging deep into their Boston street smarts to get the drop on the other. But wait a minute. The book is all Boston. The movie is set in Brooklyn. And Dennis Lehane has moved to California. Jesus, Mary and Joseph, what is going on? Dennis Lehane, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You have moved to California recently. That was an earthquake here.
Yes. We went to test it for a year because I was getting so much work. And in that 12-month period, my wife and kids turned around and said, you know, 348 days of really nice weather. That's kind of fun.
Well, I'm wondering, too, if the move to California was partially about the scene kind of changing here. I mean, this Boston that you've written about so exquisitely is changing.
It's funny because that's a lot of what The Drop, ultimately the book The Drop is about the sort of vanishing world and how hard you try to hold on to that. There's one character in the book who truly can't let go of the past, and he's the most dangerous guy in the book.
Which one? There's so many dangerous ones. I'm trying to
Cousin
think.
Marv, I would
Cousin
say,
Marv.
Ultimately becomes, as the book progresses, because you don't know where he stands. he becomes very dangerous to Bob.
There's a moment where cousin Bob visits him, and there's a viciousness to Marv.
Yeah.
But there's also a sweetness. He lives with his sister. They get in their barkalounges every night and watch TV.
My favorite scenes in the book are the scenes with him and his sister. And they were scenes that I fought really hard to keep in the movie. And they ultimately ended up getting in the movie, I think, because Gandolfini just kicked them, hit them out of the park.
This is James Gandolfini, who plays Marv, again, sort of the older, more heartless, you know, than Bob. Bob seems to have a core. But it's interesting, I have to tell you, when I was reading the book, I'd heard, oh, Gandolfini's in the movie. I thought he was Bob.
Oh, it's interesting.
Bob, who lives in the house that his parents lived and died, and he still lives in the same house.
Yep.
He can't seem to break out of the go to mass every day, do your work, be a good boy. I pictured Gandolfini as that. I'm wondering, is that something that's tough for an author? It used to be we'd form our vision of the characters and then we'd see what the movie cast them at. Now people are going to be reading the book with the characters already formed.
That's okay. I've never had trouble with the casting of my books because I never lock on physically to characters unless there's something very specific about their physicality.
Wait, you don't have a picture in your mind's eye?
I have a picture, but it's a little vaguer than you'd think. When I was writing this, the book, well, I'd already written the script. I'd already seen the first draft of the film. So I already knew who was who. It didn't affect me any more or less.
Well, it's affecting me.
Okay,
because,
that's good.
Again, I had James Gandolfini in the role of Bob, who has this sweet core to him.
And I know he's, in real life, it's Tom Hardy who plays the part.
Right. And Bob makes the observation. I want to go back to you talking about this idea that change is in the air. Bob goes over to that sad little barkalounger TV room, and he's sitting there, and he says it's like a calendar that people forgot to change the page.
Yeah. And by the end of the book, he is looking at the lives of his friends and saying, nobody's moved on here.
Except for Dennis, who moved to California and left everyone behind.
Boy, I am getting crucified today, and I deservedly so. Fair enough, but I am getting crucified today in the city for this.
We can't help but read and see some of these layers of your own story. You moved on from this neighborhood in a way, I mean, just in a physical way, although you're still writing about it. And then, oh, gosh, the dog.
Oh, there was no connection between that. That was what was so surreal.
Well, let's explain.
On December 24th, 2012, I believe, I kind of famously lost a dog because it was a slow news week.
And people responded to this idea that people who didn't even know it was you.
It was so wonderful. The outpouring of people's response to that was forever moved me. Then I have a book in which a guy finds an abandoned dog. It was completely 100% coincidental. The first chapter was written in 2001,
long
11
before
years
you lost Tessa.
Before I lost Tessa. So,
but I just wondered, in the drop the book,
You
can maybe embellish a little on that experience. And I was just wondering what you were saying about what an animal does to the character Bob.
Well, the original title of the short story, the original working title of the script, and the title of the first chapter of this book is Animal Rescue. And that was always what it was to me. Not just you're rescuing the animal is rescuing you, because Bob is a guy who's in need of rescuing. And then he finds this dog. And in finding the dog, he meets a woman. And in meeting the woman, he begins to open up his heart. And the moment he opens up his heart, all these negative forces begin to press in on him.
Well, how did you up and move this thing that we think we know, the going to mass and then maybe casually committing a murder the next day? How did that move to Brooklyn?
To Brooklyn. The producers approached me first and said, we're worried that essentially the Boston crime-based story has become a victim of yours and Ben Affleck's success. That between Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone and The Town, you're looking at this slew of films that came out of Boston, all ultimately kind of about that. What if we went somewhere as where? And they said Brooklyn. And I was just about to move to Brooklyn myself for 3 months to work on Boardwalk Empire. I said, well, I'll be there. So, sure, let's give it a shot.
What did you do that made it Brooklyn as opposed to—
Honestly, nothing. I didn't do anything.
What does that say to you?
I can't pretend not to be a tourist looking in through a window. That's what I was.
But I'm wondering if it says that people who are trapped in their neighborhoods and in the violence, they can't trust the cops because they'll, you know.
I think that's universal. This sense, I think, that the world is, for most people, a lawless world. I don't think that's unheard of. particularly in poor cultures.
So, Dennis Lehane, you live in California now. You're being told that maybe this thing that you just were the best at, capturing a certain voice, giving even the most inhumane their humanity, you know, finding the humanity.
Sure.
What are you going to do now? What are you?
And keep doing it. And keep doing it. And Hemingway wrote best about Michigan when he was in Paris. He wrote best about Paris when he was in Idaho. I'm never, ever, ever not writing. My novels will all be set in Boston from this point. I will never stray afield. I can write scripts set anywhere. I can do that. But for Boston, I always want to be in this world.
Well, and it's one you know well. Dennis Lehane, his latest book is The Drop, adapted from the screenplay of the new film. We'll post an excerpt at hereandnow.org.
Thank you.
Thank you. And by the way, the film opens tomorrow.
Pittsburgh plays Baltimore in NFL football tonight, but the game could be overshadowed by the ongoing story of Ray Rice, the former Ravens running back, seen on video knocking his then-fiancée, now-wife, unconscious in an elevator in February. The Ravens released Rice after the video became public, and the NFL has suspended him indefinitely. But former FBI Director Robert Mueller has been appointed now to investigate the lingering questions about how the NFL and Commissioner Roger Goodell have handled the case. Here and Now sports analyst Mike Pesca hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. He's with us now. And Mike, a lot of questions about whether the NFL had access to that video earlier than they are letting on.
Yeah, that's the crux of the biggest thing they're trying to fight back. Roger Goodell has categorically denied ever seeing this. He says that publicly. He sent a letter to owners, which has been published in several publications, who got their hands on it. He maintains that once he saw the tape, that changed everything. Contradicting that are two facts. One is, at the time, many reporters said that the NFL had seen the tape, and the tape in these reporters' relaying of that information, the tape maybe had some exculpatory or exonerating parts about Ray Rice, the implication being maybe he was fighting back his much lesser and weaker fiance at the time. The other thing contradicting that is an AP report that came out yesterday from a law enforcement source saying, I sent the tape to the NFL, and that source played a tape of someone from the NFL essentially confirming that the NFL got the tape. Can I just say, though, that even though clear and bright evidence of a lie would be incredibly damaging to the NFL, I fail to see the importance of this. Sure, maybe Roger Goodell's job would be threatened if it's proved categorically that he lied, but what did the NFL expect to see in a tape? The police report said Jhené, then Palmer, was concussed by Ray Rice. Ray Rice was the only one in the elevator. I suppose that the horror of the tape can't be unseen, but it still seems extremely curious to me that the tape changed everything. It seems sort of a willing blindness to me on the part of the NFL.
Still, anybody who has seen that tape, if it comes out that Goodell or anyone else at the NFL saw that tape, would that person saw that tape and didn't do anything about it, would that person have to go?
It would seem, because this is contradicting the NFL's. This is their bulwark against the calls for the commissioner to resign. And the calls come from columnists and women's rights activists and nothing even close to an owner or one of the 32 people who could actually compel Roger Goodell to resign. But yeah, if there was evidence, clear evidence of a cover-up, then something would have to happen. I guess because the reptilian parts of our brain really understand lying, and maybe it takes a higher mental process to understand ham-handedness, cluelessness, or misogyny, and those seem readily apparent in this case.
Well, and is this doing damage to the NFL beyond Roger Goodell or anybody who has to resign as a result of this?
Tremendous damage. If you had asked me a couple weeks ago, can anything overshadow week one of the NFL? I mean, how big would that story have to be? I'd think of something, you know, preposterously huge. CBS paid $300 million for 8 Thursday night games. I know you referenced Pittsburgh and Baltimore in the intro. It will totally be overshadowed by this. This has become the biggest embarrassment that the NFL has dealt with, and they've dealt with concussions, and they've dealt with Richie Incognito, and they've dealt with plenty of embarrassments during Roger Goodell's tenure.
But what does that damage mean to them?
I think it means in the short term, they're still an extremely wealthy organization. Americans still love professional football, but perhaps for the first time, Goodell's tenure and his $44.2 million paycheck are at least being threatened.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
There are just 54 days left until the midterm election, so let's get to our Senate tracker. This week, we are looking at a race that was considered a safe Republican seat, and now it's a toss-up. I'm talking about Kansas, where the incumbent senator, Republican Pat Roberts, was expected to be easily reelected, but then Democrat Chad Taylor dropped out of the race and is suing to get taken off the ballot. Republicans want him to stay on, though, because of a challenge from a third candidate, independent Greg Orman. Peggy Lowe of Here and Now contributing station KCUR in Kansas City joins us with more. Peggy, welcome.
Hey, Jeremy. Nice to be here.
Well, explain, first of all, why Chad Taylor, the Democrat, wanted to be taken off the ballot in the first place.
He announced this last week and he signed papers with the Secretary of State saying, I want my name to be removed from the ballot. This was done, it came out like in the next couple of days, at the urging of Democrats, specifically Senator Claire McCaskill, a very strategic thinker on the Missouri side of the DNC. So he tried to step aside. The Secretary of State, at the odd urging sort of the Republican Party in trying to keep a Democrat on the ticket, the Secretary of State, who is a Republican, Chris Kobach, finally ruled that Taylor had to stay on the ballot because he didn't comply with state law in his letter to him.
So he'll stay on the ballot even though he's not running?
Well, so far, yes. Now, Chad Taylor has filed a petition with the Kansas Secretary of State saying, Kobach is now violating my First Amendment rights by not allowing me to do what I want to do politically. And so the Kansas Supreme Court will be deciding this matter, and they will need to make that decision by next Thursday when the ballot must be set by state law.
Okay, well, let's take a look at the candidates that we know want to be on the ballot, starting with Senator Pat Roberts, who's been in office since 1997. Here he is speaking at his first debate with Greg Orman at the Kansas State Fair in Hutchinson, Kansas.
We must stop the Obama agenda, but before we can do that, we have to break Harry Reid's stranglehold on the Senate. The House has passed. The House has passed over 350 bills, all of which are stuck in the Senate, where now good legislation goes to die. The choice is clear. I am the only candidate on this stage that will vote to put Harry Reid out to pasture and break the gridlock.
Okay, and here is the independent candidate and businessman Greg Orman at the debate.
Our system of government is broken, and we all know it. We're sending the worst of both parties there, bitter partisans who care more about pleasing extremists than they do solving problems. And we have serious problems to solve as a nation. From healthcare and higher education affordability to stagnant wages to living within our means as a country. If we don't solve these problems, our status in the world, our standard of living, and the very existence of the middle class in America is at risk.
So, Peggy, Greg Orman, he's an independent. Does he come off as more of a Republican or a Democrat?
Well, interestingly enough, he is an independent, you know, as his party affiliation. That said, he ran as a Democrat in 2008 briefly, and he dropped out of the primary. He was running against Roberts as a Democrat back then. Here's what's so fascinating to me about Orman now. He's essentially running against Congress, not just Roberts. You know, he's running against the idea of this bipartisan gridlock back there, send somebody who's independent. And he has publicly said, if elected, I will caucus with the party I feel is trying to solve problems.
Hmm. And what about Pat Roberts? What is he running on this time around?
Pat Roberts is running against basically what he considers the liberals in Washington. He said the name Harry Reid so often at that state fair event that you just played that he was finally being ridiculed for it and booed for it. Hmm. So he believes he needs to be running against the Democrats.
And what about for voters? What are the big issues in this race?
The big issue for voters are things like the fact that Pat Roberts has been in Washington since the 1960s, when he was a staffer, then he was elected to Congress in the 80s, and now he's been, as you said, a senator since the 90s. He doesn't even have a residence in Kansas. He joked in a New York Times article a few months ago that he has a recliner at one of his friends' homes in Dodge City. Many voters, too, are very much worried about a conservative effort that hasn't gone the way the governor here, Sam Brownback, has suggested it would. He has made very draconian cuts across the board in state agencies and in income taxes. And so far, his what he calls experiment is not working.
Is there a lot of outside money coming into this race, especially now that it has taken such a turn and has attracted so much national attention?
So far, the money isn't coming, but certainly the GOP strategists are. For instance, after Chad Taylor dropped out of the race last week, the GOP sent in two big strategists, and they started the running the campaign this weekend. And they say that they're going to be refocusing it, and they are basically going to be, you know, really pounding on the repeal of Obamacare. So, and also the independent Greg Orman, he's raised most of his own money. It's been in dribs and drabs in some of his own fortune. He's a businessman from the suburbs of Kansas City.
It's pretty impressive that Kansas, which is the state that really is deep red when it comes to presidential elections and has been now for many of them, is turning out to be a hot Senate race that could go either way.
It's very interesting, Jeremy, and I think you really see kind of a political revolt going on here, out here in the heartland. You know, the Senate hasn't had a Democrat from Kansas since the 1930s, when Herbert Hoover was president.
And by the way, when Wizard of Oz came out, and the image of Kansas that we had was Dorothy wanting to go back there.
And so, you know, to use your metaphor, tornado is now moving through the state. You know, some of the Republicans are really angry that the conservative experiment by Governor Brownback is just not working, it seems. You know, we have a lot of job losses. We're doing much poorer compared to even other states in the Midwest as far as the economy, as far as education, as far as jobs. Greg Orman is running on jobs. He says, as a venture capitalist, and he is, you know, invested in all these local businesses, he's created jobs. So he's really talking bread and butter issues, and he's fighting against Congress.
What are the polls saying?
They're in a dead heat. A poll out this week suggests that Greg Orman is just one percentage point above Pat Roberts right now, which is really amazing, like you say, in this ruby red state.
Peggy Lowe of KCUR in Kansas City, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network. Peggy, thank you.
Jeremy, thanks very much.
And if you want to take a look at some of the other races we've looked at in our Senate Tracker series, go to hereandnow.org. We've got a look at the race in Alaska, in Colorado, in Kentucky, and in Arkansas. The Golden State has been my home, but I place my state to roam and to rage. The good souls of men, but teach me.
The band Delta Spirit was formed in sunny California, but the songs for the band's latest album were written in a Brooklyn studio called The Rat Cave, and it might have really lived up to that name after it was ruined by Superstorm Sandy in 2012. The band rebuilt the studio and produced this new album, Into the Wide, out this week. Take shelter. That's Take Shelter from the new Delta Spirit CD, Into the Wide. The lyrics continue, when the skies light up and the ground shudders, we'll be there with each other. Well, weirdly, the band was actually in Hawaii being evacuated from a potential tsunami when Sandy hit. But their wives, families, homes, their studio were all back in New York. Singer-guitarist Matt Vasquez joins us from KERA in Dallas. So, Matt, is this song about that time?
Yeah, it is. Actually, Kelly Winrich in the band wrote that song. He was inspired from the very depressing movie Melancholia. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
It's like this movie, it's set at a wedding and the world is ending and everybody's lives are kind of falling apart, but you're trying to get the connection with people and still have hope. Hmm. And so after I saw that movie, I understood the song, but after I saw that film, I held my wife extra tight that night. Just thinking about the song and that movie and just being like, you know. We're all going to die.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, that's something, it feels like there was a lot of pummeling, a lot of incoming, you know, whether it's Superstorm Sandy or in a movie, it feels like members of the band were feeling a little vulnerable.
Yeah. You know, we've been in a band now, this band, Delta Spirit, for 9 years. It'll be 10 in January. And just all the relationships and going through everything together and having to rebuild the space and work on songs and see if we can still connect with each other in the studio and songwriting creatively. Hold my hand, hold my hand up, hold my hand.
You have now produced this album about survival, but also there's one song about someone who doesn't make it, a young woman named Juliet, who apparently, if I'm reading the lyrics right, you know, jumped off the John Muir Trail.
Yeah.
Have I got that right?
Yeah. It's a figurative story. It's from some personal experience. Really confused young spiritual person got brought to a place called IHOP, the International House of Prayer in Kansas City, Missouri. And from there, it's very evangelical and free. And a lot of people were saying, well, I feel like God's telling me this and God's telling me that. That experience is what really led me to my agnosticism. And we all share different faiths from atheism to Christianity, but we all get along in that. And that's,
well, so
this song is kind of that.
But you were the one that went to this, International House of Prayer, not pancakes, evangelical church. And so this is in part about that. So nobody jumped off the John Muir Trail. Well, that's good.
No.
But let's listen to a little bit of the song. It's called Patriarch. But there is that reference, shaking on the floor, speaking tongues of angels. Had you done that? Did your church speak in tongues? Really?
Yeah, I was in need. I was a pretty troubled kid and dropping acid as a freshman in high school and just having a crazy time. And had a moment where the paramedics took me. And Christianity was a big thing that helped me get out of the situation I was in. And later in my teen years, I investigated that mystic tongues, gifts stuff. And then when I got older, I thought more about my Freudian God. I'm more interested in the what is than what I perceive now.
All right. Okay. So so these songs are tracking some
changes.
That's
a lot of stuff.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. Well, there's also something very much what is, very much in the moment. It's a song about bullying. It's called Live On. Let's listen to a little of that. When the girl hit the ground, I threw the padlock in the trash. Finally found out just how much it takes for one whole year he spent making me turn red. Forget the light ahead. Forget the light ahead. So who wrote this? Is this someone's?
Did.
And then was this your personal experience?
Yeah, it was.
Tell me more.
Well, I went through bullying when I was in eighth grade and had this kid calling me gay my whole eighth grade year and trying to fight me. I just had enough of it, and I hit him right in the face in the last week of my eighth grade year. And that's really the first verse, and just kind of confronting that within yourself and not letting people just step all over you.
Yeah. Well, there's one more we wanted to note. It's, I don't know, you tell us. Is this an anti-war song? Let's listen. Matt Vasquez, what prompted this one?
Just frustration with the last record and all the Arab Spring stuff that was happening. It was like right as that started ramping up, and kind of the excitement for people to kind of have democracy and not be stepped all over. And, you know, like a lot of people are just so sick of us being at war. And trying to challenge myself to do something about it. And that's what the song's about.
It's interesting. And it comes at a time. We just heard the president speak.
Yeah.
And the polls show that, interestingly, two-thirds of Americans are interested in some sort of military response to what's going on now, ISIS. It's interesting.
Yeah, it is. I'm just sick of it. In my heart and in my mind, I wish peace for people. And everybody that's saying yes to this whole intervention also wants that too, beheading people and taking away people's rights. It's really complicated over there, obviously. It's just my opinion.
And your song.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Matt Vasquez. He sings, plays guitar for the band Delta Spirit. Their new CD is called Into the Wide. Hey, Matt, thanks so much. And
thank you, Robin.
Yeah, have fun on the tour.
Will do.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.